Hello, everyone, and welcome to Negotiating Ideas, a podcast about political thought on democracy and pluralism. My name is Omar Sadr. I am a research associate at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Governance and Markets. My guest in this episode is Professor Abdullahi Al-Nahim, who is teaching law at Emory University, and he's also a senior fellow at the Center for Study of Law and Religion at Emory University. An internationally recognized scholar of Islam and human rights, his research interests include constitutionalism in Islamic and African countries, secularism, and Islam and politics. He's author of several groundbreaking books and papers, including the one which is called Towards an Islamic Reformation, Civil Liberties and Human Rights, An Islam and Secular State, Negotiating Sharia, published in 2010, among many other great books. In this conversation, I would like to speak with Professor Al-Nahim about some of the contemporary challenges of Muslim world, including how to embrace human rights, how to move forward with a model of state which should pave the way towards a pluralistic, peaceful coexistence. So let me start by asking you the question, Professor Al-Nahim. You're an advocate of secularism in the Muslim context. Tell us about your theory, how secularism is suitable and why it's important for Muslims to embrace the idea of secularism.
To clarify a couple of points to begin with, I am just retired from Emory University, so I'm currently no longer teaching. I'm an emeritus professor of Emory University Law School. I deliberately call it this Islam and the secular state, not secularism.
Yes.
Because secularism is a broader philosophical, cultural phenomena that exists in different modes, in different societies over time. But what I'm concerned with specifically is the secularity of the state.
Sure.
And the argument is simply because this is essential for the sort of state we have today.
Mm-hmm.
That is the post-colonial state, I call it, states which were established by colonial powers throughout the Muslim world, throughout the 20th century, are new to the region, to history of Islam and Muslims. We used to live with imperial states. As Europeans did and as the rest of the world, China and others did. But in the colonialism or post-colonial expansion globally, a sort of state that is bureaucratic, territorial, centralized, with massive, expansive powers, was established throughout the region for the first time in the history of these societies. That sort of state, we needed to be secular. By secular, I mean one that is neutral regarding religion. It is not neutral regarding everything else, because it's not neutral regarding national security, it's not neutral regarding development, environment. There are all sorts of policy issues that the state has to take a position on. Religion is absolutely not one of them.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my argument is to say that the state is incapable of having a religion. The state is a political institution.
Sure.
It cannot have a faith. It cannot have a religion. So when you call a state Islamic, what you mean, it is a state that is controlled by people who impose their view of Islam on the population at large. That's why I'm opposed to an Islamic state. My claim is that it never existed. It is incapable of existence, conceptually and historically.
Sure.
But we need the state to be neutral. We need it to stay away from religion, because it corrupts religion, and it is corrupted by religion. That's my position.
Sure. There are two points here that you flagged. One is that the current state is post-colonial. And that struck me because the contemporary political Islam or Islamist project of Sharia state or Islamic state is a contradiction, because they assume that by employing the state to implement religion, they have fulfilled their religious duty. But in fact, it is it's a colonial project that they undertake, because Islam and the Sharia, as you analyzed, has been quite a pluralistic code of moral law.
Yes.
It was never codified before the modern times, and particularly before Ottomans started in second half of 19th century, and later, of course, British India also followed. So the codification of Islamic law transformed a very nuanced, pluralistic moral code into very static assimilationist model. And now that has been since then a kind of model for multiple other Muslim countries to follow, particularly in terms of family law. So how can we communicate this to the Islamists, that the project that they have undertaken itself as a colonial project, it's not something which is rooted in the medieval era experience of Muslim empires?
Exactly. I think that's my project. In fact, Islam and the Secular State, the book, now is just published, the second edition of it in Arabic. And I have translations of it in various languages of Muslim societies, Urdu, Bengali, Farsi, others, on the website that I used to hold, and I will keep having it as drafts. My object is to reach Muslims in their own languages, to make the point that the Islamist project is a total fallacy. It is a new colonial project in every sense. Because it imposes the European idea of the state and the European idea of law over a very rich and nuanced, as you put it, and complex history of Islam jurisprudence. The greatness of Sharia is precisely in its diversity. In its acceptance of difference, in its tolerance of disagreement, that none of the founding scholars of Islam allowed their own views to be imposed on anybody else. In fact, they resisted, and some of them were even tortured for refusing to hold state positions. That is the history of Islam jurisprudence. Because the idea is that nobody has the right to speak in the name of God. Ali ibn Abi Talib, the Imam of the Shia, the first Imam of the Shia, said, "The Quran does not speak. It is men who speak for the Quran." And as soon as you realize, as he rightly said, that the Quran does not speak, hold it and listen. It does not tell you anything. It is some person who is telling you this is what the Quran is saying. And that person is telling you his view of what the Quran is saying. That's why I need the state to stay, the state authority and the state coercive power to stay out of this. Let Muslims debate these issues among themselves voluntarily, peacefully, outside the state framework.
Sure.
But the idea of European rigid for codification, as you said rightly, it was for the first time in Muslim history, it was the Ottomans through the Majella who started enacting a single school on a particular issue. Not the totality of Sharia. Even the Ottomans and Indian, the British India, did not attempt to codify Sharia because it is uncodifiable.
Yeah.
Which view of Sharia will you codify? But they codified in the Ottoman case property law and contract law of the Hanafi school only. But if you take the Malik school or the Shafi school or any of the other schools on the same issues, you'll find different opinions. So why the Hanafi? Because the state of the Ottomans was a Hanafi state.
Yeah.
Or imposed the Hanafi school. That's what I am saying here.
And the contradiction is evident because you see the North African countries where which was under Ottoman rules, they were not Hanafis.
Yes,
exactly. Other North Africans, exactly. Maliki and Shafi, but since the empire was endorsing, appropriating Hanafi jurisprudence, so still till now, the official religious recognized sect in these countries are Hanafi. So now let's move on to the point that you spoke about the state neutrality, but you have a very, very specific understanding of state neutrality, by which you mean, well, a state institutionally should distance itself from the ideology or idea of religion. But at the same time, you also argue that Muslims or a state should, or public policy should, have certain reflections of sentiments and values and opinions of its citizens, and that includes religion. And then you bring the idea of civic reason, which means that people can advocate a policy based on religious standpoint, but not invoking exclusionary ideology of one religion, presenting it in a state through rational or reason, which is communicable to others and a Muslims and a society in general. I mean, a rational reason which is not necessarily based on a religion. So explain to the audience, what do you mean? How, for example, societies like Afghanistan, which are not much religiously diverse, unfortunately now, predominantly one religion, also ruled with a very totalitarian regime of the Taliban. Or maybe, let's say, most of the Muslim societies, like Pakistan, even if it's not ruled by a religious state, but it's democracy in a certain sense. But how can we embrace in these societies your idea of civic reason to advocate secularism?
Okay, by civic reason, I mean not that it is based on religious rationale, but that the advocate may have a religious motivation. But the rationale has to be accessible to all citizens equally, without regard whatsoever to any religion or lack of religion. The point being that you cannot deny people the motivation to be religious and to advocate certain ideas because of the religious convictions.
In other words, if I interfere, you recognize the right to freedom of religion.
Exactly. Exactly. So it is a question of the American First Amendment of the American Constitution put it superbly when it said freedom of religion, freedom from religion. So that the state cannot interfere with people's religious beliefs, but the state cannot impose the religious belief of anybody. So the point, therefore, is that by civic reason, I use civic reason to make it broader than Rawls' idea of public reason, or Habermas and others. Because to me, public reason in that discourse is limited and does not permit the varieties of cultural and epistemological and ideas that other societies may have. It's a European idea for North America, North and Western Europe, and that's fine. But they cannot be for the totality of humanity. But let people say, keep the state out of any religious, I call it equidistance, the phrase that is used by the Indian constitution. The state should keep an equal distance from all religions. Mm-hmm. Or all faith and beliefs, including non-religious or anti-religious beliefs as well. Meaning that it stays out of this field altogether. But in a democratic situation, people will have reasons for voting for X or Y. We cannot go into people's hearts and minds to decide, no, you can't vote for X because of we think that he is a good person or a bad person from this point of view or the other. But the point is that, and here come the absolutely non-negotiable condition, constitutional fundamental rights. That is, no view of anybody or any political party or any organization can be allowed to violate the constitution. For that reason, not simply because we cannot have a state that can be run by the rule of law and democratic principles if it's allowed to violate the constitution. What's the point of having a constitution if the state can do so? So therefore, if anybody advocating views that, for example, violate the rights of women or violate the rights of non-Muslims, that view is unconstitutional and therefore cannot be allowed. Mm-hmm. No matter what my religious motivation for advocating that view may be. Mm-hmm. That is my position.
So in that sense, you say irrespective of your religious interpretation or understanding, there are certain unchangeable universal principles which should be acknowledged and accepted beforehand, even before presenting civic reason, and that is human rights.
Yes.
Now, the question is, don't you think that even the idea of human rights itself is contentious, even not in a religious society, but in Westerns also, in Western society, because it's an expanding territory.
Okay. If I may, I published the most recent book, I should say, not the last book I published, the most recent book I published called Decolonizing Human Rights, which was published by Cambridge University Press 2021. And in that book, I argued that the universality of human rights must be inclusive, instead of being a universalization of liberal ideology and neo-colonial policies. It should be inclusive by what I call promoting what I call overlapping consensus.
That or cross-cultural
cross-cultural understanding that creates an overlapping consensus over what human rights are. So to me, yes, by all means, human rights, as we have them in the Universal Declaration and the UN documents, is contentious and should be, because it was an imperial universalization of a colonial project. But we should not abandon or give up on the idea of human right, universal human rights, because of that history.
Sure.
But we should claim it for ourselves. And we should demand the right to define what human rights mean for us. We are not excluding anybody else's, but we are not submitting to anybody else's view what human rights ought to be. And that debate, which promotes an overlapping consensus, is what I call, in the book I call it, cultural transformation and political mobilization, which is particularly relevant to your country, Afghanistan, my country, Sudan.
Sure.
Because we need to transform the cultural attitudes of our people regarding the rights of women, regarding the rights of non-Muslims, of other Muslims who disagree with us even.
Sure.
And that transformation is essential for promoting the political mobilization that will enable us to promote universal human rights from within our cultures, rather than import them from New York or Geneva.
Right. I totally understand what you are saying. And this would be, of course, a kind of intellectual exercise, which should be undertaken by scholars, human rights activists, practitioners, jurists, for example. But walk us through how that should be exercised, for example, at this moment, vis-a-vis the gender apartheid totalitarian regime of the Taliban. They claim certain understanding based on a script.
Yeah.
And the most, of course, international community, most of the citizens in Afghanistan call upon international community to sanction the Taliban, to pressurize them, to transform their idea vis-a-vis their citizens. it doesn't happen. So how can we practically embrace this cross-cultural understanding of human rights?
That's why the entire book, Islam and the Secular State, makes an Islamic case for what I'm talking about. And that Islamic case, tracing the history of the state in Muslim history, tracing the nature of the state, the nature of Sharia itself, or what we mean by Sharia, how did it come about? And when I think what we need to do is to challenge the very premise of the Taliban argument. Once we concede that premise, then we have lost the argument to our people. And the fact that we can win it with the international community is irrelevant. Because the so-called international community is neither international nor a community. What we call the international community is the same colonial powers which divided Africa into regions of European influence back in 1885, in the Berlin Conference of 1885, and colonized the entire continent of Africa. According to that conference. And the fact that the same powers created the Security Council, established the UN Security Council to check the power of the international, truly international community of the United Nations. Because only the Security Council can issue binding resolutions. Only the Security Council can decide almost every issue, including amendments of the UN General Charter. So my point is that when I trace that history, I do that in the book, and I do it in the Decolonizing Human Rights, to show that we should not shy away from challenging every premise, including the premise that we look to the international community to protect our rights. Once we do that, then we lost the cause.
Sure.
Because our people will side with the Taliban against us because we are invoking the international community, so-called, which is European powers, over the sovereignty of our own societies.
How about religious reformation in the Muslim world, which is probably one of the very first steps towards this cross-cultural understanding of human rights. Why do you think Muslims has failed probably multiple times in the last 100 years, one century, since late 19th or early 20th century? Reformers like Jamaluddin al-Afghani or Rashid Rza, for example, or in South Asia, Muhammad Iqbal, they were all rationalists. You also highlight, you start your book, Islam and the Secular State, by highlighting the fact that scholars like Ali Abdul Razak has argued in favor of the state as a secular. It's a political entity, not a religious entity. But unfortunately, at the moment that we are speaking, Islamic reformation has not been able to transform the entire religious understanding. Or in other words, if I say, unlike Christianity, where reformation led to formation of another sect, which amended certain methodological ways that we understand religion or Christianity. In Islam, it didn't happen. The reformists were not able to methodologically transform religion. Are there any possibilities that we do it successfully in future?
Of course. Of course, absolutely. The point, I think, it's a loss of confidence on our part due to colonialism, again. Because I think it was, I don't know exactly who said it, but it's a very profound statement. He said that colonialism is a consequence, not a cause. It's a consequence of inner defeat. It's a consequence of loss of confidence. It's a confidence of lack of understanding of our own history and our own tradition. Not the cause of it. And I think that that's where we have to go. We have to start by questioning our abandonment of our own history and culture in favor of European ideas, which, by the way, are much more recent, extremely recent, compared to the same ideas and values that existed in Muslim tradition, in Muslim jurisprudence. All these ideas existed 1,000 years ago in the discourse of Muslim scholars throughout, from Andalusia to India. And especially your region, the South Asia region, the Central Asia region, was the richest and the most profound regions in their scholarship, in their insights, in their power of transformation. But we abandoned all of this and look to the West now. And that's where the problem is. The West is fine for the West, but the West is not fine for the East. Even the idea of East and West itself implies that dichotomy. The West, so-called, or ideology of liberal ideas and philosophies, even rationalism is also a relative concept. I mean, your rationality may not necessarily be mine. What we do is we present our rationalities for debate among ourselves in our societies. And in that regard, I think that the possibilities of understanding when we say that Islam has failed or Muslim reforms have failed, I think that is the nature of human development, that you find that, look at the most fundamental ideas that now we all take for granted. Einstein's idea of relativity or philosophical ideas that we now take, any of these ideas took centuries to take hold in their own societies. So why is it different for us? Why should we expect that overnight we are going to overcome historical repression and by all our own people, by the way? Of course, the repression and the authoritarianism is not the sort of monopoly of the West. It is our imperial Western powers. Muslim rulers have, despotic rulers have exercised these powers for centuries over other Muslims, that Muslims took it for granted that this is the way of the world, this is what God's will is. No, I say this is not God's will. This is the will of those who control the state, and I'm here to challenge it. So going to your point about reformation, yes. Whether we call it, my first book actually is called Islam, it's called Toward an Islamic Reformation, as you said, which 1990 in English came out. It is an idea of transformation from within using an Islamic reform methodology of shifting from verses of the Quran of the Medina period to those of the Mecca period. And the Quran is distinguishing these terms throughout the Mus'haf. Any verse you read, you can immediately tell, and it will tell you, was this verse revealed in Mecca or Medina? But the difference is not only the location of revelation, it is the level of revelation. The Quran of Mecca was universal, its principles. And you will see, you read it, Ya Ayyuhan Nas. It does not say Ya Ayyuhal Ladhina Amanu, as in the Quran of Medina. Yeah. So the Quran of Medina was addressed to believers, Muslims, contextually. The Quran of Mecca was addressed to the universality of humanity at large. So the scholar I personally follow, his methodology is called Ustaz Mahmoud Muhammad Taha, a Sudanese, who was, by the way, was executed for apostasy in the 1980s, 1985, January 1985, argues that we have to shift from the Quran of Medina to the Quran of Mecca. And that shift is within the Quran. It is not outside the Quran. And that shift is simply addressing a human choice in the first place. Because the focus of Sharia on the Quran of Medina was a choice of the scholars of Sharia back in 1300 years ago. But shifting now is shifting to a choice of Muslim scholars of the 21st century addressing the needs of societies of the 21st century. So it is as Islamic as Sharia has ever been. And that's how we can persuade people, Muslims, that they can take us seriously.
Other North African reformist scholars like Abid al-Jabiri has also advocated almost the same way. Like, he goes on to the extent that he says Muslims at this moment can abandon hudud, as we understand it in classic Sharia. And his methodology is also, he's offering an alternative methodology for understanding Sharia. Verses should be interpreted based on asbab and nuzul, the rationale for its revelation. And probably it has, that's why context becomes much, much important. When you consider asbab and nuzul. Coming to the idea of secularism, that you spoke earlier about how we should not embrace the Western idea as it is, blindly. Your understanding of secularism is also nuanced in a sense that you say secularism is not an ideal type, which should be universally the same across the world. We have to understand secularism in a comparative lens.
Yes.
Where there are multiple secularisms.
Yes.
The French model is different from the Indonesian model, and Indonesian model is substantially different from the American model.
Yes.
As major examples, if we... So I think this is also helpful for the Muslim society, in that they should not reject outright secularism without understanding the differences. So walk us through this point. What do you mean by a comparative understanding of secularism, and how that is related to the idea of pluralism?
I think one of the spectacular successes of Islamist discourse is to demonize the idea of secular state and secularism as Western, amoral, depraved, and all the language that we hear in our mosques. And religious institutions. By creating that myth of a secularism that is inherently amoral and depraved and so on, they totally close off any understanding of secularism and the secular state in the nuanced relative sort of interactive terms that I'm trying to promote. To say that, therefore, to understand that it is absolutely amazing how naive and ill-informed, but actually I would say with all due respect also, speaking from Sudan experience, a very manipulative discourse of the Islamist who know better. People like Hassan Turabi, who, by the way, was used to teach at the same University of Khartoum that I studied law in the 1980s. I studied in the 1960s. He just retired to become a full-time politician. He was a constitutional lawyer. He was his PhDs or doctorates from the Sorbonne and masters from Britain. All his education, all his making is Western. And yet he totally embraced this idea of a quote-unquote Islamic, this Islamic that, in contradistinction to Western this and Western that. And by the way, also to notice that none of the Islamists, whether it is the Taliban or the National Islamic Front in Sudan or any other has suggested anything to do with amending or adjusting the European post-colonial neo-colonial state. They embrace the idea of the territorial European state.
Yes.
They embrace the idea of European law.
In that sense, the political project is modernist.
Yes, absolutely. And they use that to impose a very archaic and very chauvinistic and narrow view of Sharia that discriminates against women, against non-Muslims, and against dissent at large, and so on. So my point is to say that we have to challenge all of this, to say that when I said Islamist discourse is manipulative and naive, also to think that it is not that they are naive, it is the discourse is naive, because it presents a very unilateral narrow view. Secularism is French, not the French at large. Not the French before 1905, and not the French of today even. But or when you talk about Turkey and Ataturk, it is not Turkey of today, which continues to be Islamist and secular.
Mm.
The state, the official ideology of the state is a secular state, which espouses an Islamic ideology or way of thinking, which is contested democratically so long as the constitution is protected and respected. And that's the way to go. I'm not saying that we should sweep out any reference to Islam and Sharia from our public discourse, because it remains in the hearts of minds of Muslims, whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
But we should create the fundamental barriers of constitutionalism, of the rule of law, of democratic governance, that will protect all, including the Islamists themselves.
And that connects me to, leads me to ask you the question about your distinction between normative pluralism and legal pluralism, where connected to the idea of civic reasoning, where you say there could be a religious motivation for advocating a change in public policy, but it should be articulated not through the religious reasoning, but through civic reason, understandable to the non-Muslims.
Yes.
And then you go on to argue that Sharia, what shall we do with Sharia at the end of the day? Because it's a moral body of text and law. And so how can we resolve this tension between a state law and Sharia law? And so you have a very nice distinction between this legal pluralism and normative pluralism, where you argue that legal pluralism does not make sense because in terms of, you say law has certain understanding, certain definition. A law is the text which is ratified by the state.
Right.
And Sharia has different methodology. It's not coming through a state.
Yes.
Walk us through that. What do you mean by normative pluralism, and how normative pluralism allows Sharia to be there in society, but to not dominate the state?
Because Sharia is not static.
Yeah.
So my point is that what we call Sharia, by the way, the term Sharia does not occur in the Quran or Hadith in the sense that we use it today. And it took 200 years at least for the methodology and the sources, usul al-fiqh and hadith records of people like Muslim and Bukhari and so on, to be declared authoritative so that they can be used by scholars to derive rules of so-called Sharia from it. But when you look at the term Sharia itself and you look at its history, it is not original. It was a development over time. And it was never static. And it was always contested among Muslims themselves. So my point is contestability.
Mm.
So long as opposed to rigidity. So long as what we call Sharia is contestable by methodologies that we accept, which may not be the same identical methodology that the Muslims of the 8th and 9th century adopted, then that will be a Sharia by our standards, which will not be in content and normative orientation the same Sharia of the 9th and 10th century. So therefore, the question therefore for me is to acknowledge the dynamic evolution of Sharia. In fact, my website, I call it Evolution of Sharia.
Okay.
Because I believe that Sharia must be evolved. I'm not giving up on the term or giving up on the idea of a normative Islamic frame of reference.
Okay.
But I'm just simply asking that we have to evolve that in terms of methodology and content to what we now commonly accept as rationality and common sense. It's amazing how Lawrence found it rather sadly amusing, actually, to see how many of the Islamists are actually scientists and engineers. And there is this sort of dichotomy, schizophrenic thinking. In the lab, the person is scientist or scientific, and rational, and methodologically precise. Out in the mosque, he becomes a fanatic.
Mm-hmm.
How can the same person, unless you are talking about schizophrenia of some sort, a split personality, because if you are consistent, if you are the same person in the lab or in the sort of drawing room as you are in the mosque, you should apply the same logic. Either take the mosque into the lab, which none of them will do, because they know it will not go anywhere.
Yeah.
Or bring the lab into the mosque, which is what I believe we should do.
And finally, you also consider the Islamist project as a totalitarian project.
Yes.
And this reminds me of Basim Tibi, who also argues that the entire political Islam is a totalitarian anti-Semitic project. So by that term, shall we consider a regime of the Taliban a fascist totalitarian regime?
Absolutely. As the regime of Sudan is now today. By the way, even the so-called democratic situations like Afghanistan, like Pakistan, and some Middle Eastern countries too. The point is, fascism is not just simply a racist ideology, but can be also ideologically racist or ideologically fascist. It can be culturally fascist. Fascism or totalitarianism is the notion that this notion of a claim on universal truth, that I only hold the universal truth, and anybody else who disagrees with me is necessarily a kafir or backward or this and that, all the other terms that they tend to use. The point is that, to me, the Taliban is as fascist as Hitler has been, Nazi Germany, as Mussolini has been in Europe, as Arab nationalism is. Any ideology that seeks to exclude or to diminish the equal humanity of other human beings because of race or religion or culture or gender and so on is a fascist ideology. But unfortunately, it is totalitarian, whether we call it or not. It stands to reason that it is. Because it imposes a totalitarian ideology on everybody else. The question is how to be persuasive about that. And that's why I plead for Muslims everywhere to look within and to look in ways that can be persuasive to their own communities. Because that is the way to defeat Islamic fascism.
persuasive in the sense that we have to be open up to dialogue, to advocate the tolerant understanding. But do you consider a limitations to this tolerance vis-a-vis the Islamists? To what extent a moderate or pluralistic Muslim society should tolerate Islamists? Is there a limit towards them? For example, the very famous understanding which comes from the Cold War liberals, particularly Karl Popper, that it's, I think mistakenly, it is now understood that Popper says that there is a limitation towards tolerance. You cannot tolerate the intolerant. But in fact, what he argues is that he says that this idea is actually put in the footnote of chapter 7 of his 1945 book, The Open Society. But then he also acknowledges that I do not imply, for instance, that we should always suppress the utterance of intolerant philosophies. And in a way, he says, there are intolerant philosophies. You have to understand it, listen to it. You cannot suppress it. For him, the limit comes when the other party, the intolerant, exercises violence. So then you cannot tolerate it. How about you? So now we have different strands of liberal political Islamists, or Islamists in a simple term. There are conservative Islamists, like Al-Nur party in Egypt, the Salafi Islamists. There are also Islamists who are a bit moderate, for example, that of the Turkey. They have embraced democracy, that they have embraced certain understanding of secularism. But there are also very violent, radical Islamists, like that of the Taliban, like that of Al-Qaeda. So in terms of encounter to these groups, what will be the limits of tolerance?
I think I would put the point in terms of we cannot tolerate the intolerable, not the intolerant. So certain ideas, certain sort of normative principles and so on are intolerable. And those principles we cannot tolerate.
For instance?
Exclusion of discrimination against women, discrimination against non-Muslims, repression of dissent, religious or other sort of dissent. Those ideas are intolerable. Now, anybody who advocates those ideas can be resisted not because of who he is or what their political stance is, but because they support ideas. Remember when I said that the non-negotiable in any of my thinking is the idea of fundamental constitutional rights and human rights. So anybody who stands with that, then with the violation of those principles, then I am opposed to, not because of who he is or what his history is or what his political sort of discourse is, but because of his policy positions. So when you tell me about the Nur in Egypt or this and that, my question is always, where do they stand on the rights of dissent, equality for women? The principle that, Sudan is now going through a vicious civil war. And I'm part of advocacy for peace in Sudan. And my position is always to say that the non-negotiables, equal inclusive citizenship of all Sudanese without distinction whatsoever on grounds of gender or race, religion or ethnicity and so on. So whatever shade of Islamist that you care to consider, ask the question, where do you stand regarding family law? Do you grant secure equal rights for Muslim women in marriage, regarding divorce, regarding custody of children, as you do men? If you do, then you are completely within the fold. If you don't, then you are not to be tolerated because of that. If you have a defense of that position, show it to us. Where does Islamic so-called Sharia al-Ahwal al-Shakhsiyya, Islamic family, where does it come from? Where did it originate? What were its theological as opposed to cultural sources? And so on. So that is what I said earlier about Muslims turning to be persuasive to our communities. But by not saying that I'm opposed to this because it is non-liberal or because it is intolerant. No, but not. Let's be specific. Where do you stand on these issues? How can you defend these issues or positions from an Islamic point of view, let alone what Habermas or Bober said and so on? What Islamic defense you have of diminishing the equal humanity of women, of diminishing the equal humanity of non-Muslims, who the Quran has addressed, Ya ayyuha al-nas, which the Quran said, and the Prophet والسلام, was sent, Rahmatul lil-alameen. He did not say Rahmatul lil-muslimin, or Rahmatul lil-rijal. To men. So the Quran says it is rahmah for humanity, and you seek to restrict it to your view of who is a good Muslim and a bad Muslim, and that's the argument that we should pursue.
Great. I am really grateful for your time, for sharing these wonderful ideas on Negotiating Ideas podcast. And I also welcome and invite all our listeners to read the wonderful books that you have written, including the very recent one, Decolonizing Human Rights, and the previous one, which is the Islam and the Secular State Negotiating Sharia. These are path-breaking, and anyone who has any contention or value towards a pluralistic, peaceful coexistence in a Muslim society should read these ideas. Thank you so much, Professor Al-Naim.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate very much your approach and your opening these negotiations and process of contestation. And I would welcome sharing my contact information on your website, on your contact list, so that anybody can reach me by email, by WhatsApp, by mobile number, and my website, where they can find many articles and book chapters that can be downloaded free of charge from the website itself.
Of course. And the note of this episode will include all of those, the list of the books that you have written, including your contact and email and the website.
Thank you. Anyway,
have a great day.
Thank you, Omar. Thank you so much.